Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the weekly comic snackcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka. Every week we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. We've got a good, really good week for you guys this week. We've got a lot of great books coming out. And to get everything started, let me introduce my co-host and good buddy, Mr. Jason Poliev. Jason, how you doing this week, man?
Oh, it's going to be a big week. I just had a friend that we took out for a bachelor party. He was still feeling the hangover 2 days later, and that is a good time. And got the wedding coming up,
yeah.
So it's going to be a fun week, and in between I get to read comic books, so it's all good.
So, fantastic. Well, if you're gonna have him go to the altar, gotta have him going to the altar with, I was gonna say with a smile on his face, but after what you put him through, I don't know if he'll necessarily be smiling. But at least knowing that he'll experienced all that there is to experience before getting there. So,
indeed, he has. So,
and well,
he's definitely had a good time.
Well, more than just comics, we have a few other things coming out this week too that are worth discussing, but we're going to get into those a little bit later in the show. But to start off, let's go with what it is you guys came here to hear. And we're going to start off talking about Green Lantern number 3 from DC Comics this week. Jason, why don't you go ahead and tell me what you thought about this title.
All right. I enjoyed this. This book has been getting better and better since issue 1, and it's building up and has a great climactic twist at the end. And you're going to be going, what is going to happen? And I think that's really where the speculation comes in. You know, in this book, you know, Hal Jordan's been recruited by Sinestro, his age-old enemy, to go after and destroy the Sinestro Corps, or the Yellow Lantern Corps, as they're probably more accurately called now, since Sinestro is now a Green Lantern. So they head off after Sinestro finally convinces Hal that they need to go and defeat his corps, because when they were the Sinestro Corps, he ruled with fear, but he was a fair leader. He didn't enslave people. He didn't condone rape. He had an orderly society despite being a society that was built on fear. With his corps.
And violent.
Yeah. And now that it's just his corps, the Yellow Lanterns, they have become the most wretched hive of scum and villainy, and taken over his home planet. So he's rather upset and has recruited Hal to help him defeat them, which is a rather interesting plot because apparently Hal has to go into the Yellow Lantern, the source of all the Yellow Lantern's power. He has to go into the battery. So, you know, one of the big things that gets stressed throughout this is Sinestro forcing Hal into Hal, makes Hal say, okay, I'm going to wait till 7 minutes after sunset. Have to wait till sunset. Go in 7 minutes after sunset. And, of course, as with all things that are planned, it gets shot straight to hell. So,
that's his first encounter with
when
the enemy.
When the plan starts going to hell, that's you know, pretty close to the end of the book. There's a little bit of a twist right after that. So, Justin, what were your opinions getting up to there? And we'll discuss the twist ending at that point.
Well, I gotta say that when Green Lantern reboot and it came back as number one, I really didn't like it. I read that first issue and I thought, holy crap, what did they do? This sucks. But now by issue 3, I gotta admit, it's starting to grow on me. I really am starting to like it now. The thing that still gets to me, and I think what in the first book, you have this mopey, whiny, depressed Hal that you basically just want to kick because he's acting like an abused puppy. And now, by the third issue, you're seeing this overcompensating, overly brash, hot-headed, moronic Hal Jordan that's the polar opposite.
So Hal is normal.
Closer to, yeah. Closer to. But I think it even goes beyond it to a point that even I'm beginning to get sort of frustrated with it and going, okay, Hal, I know you're not that dumb, dude. I mean, you can't be that big of an idiot. I know, I mean, he's not a big brain. He's, you know, not Batman. He's not a master strategist. But he's not a moron. or at least he hadn't been written as one previously. And I don't know if they're actually making this a turn to the of the character as well, because I get that same sort of impression from him in the Justice League titles as well, that he may be the bright light, but he's still the dim bulb, if you kind of catch my drift there. So, that aside, I mean, because that grates on me, but not enough to make me dislike the book. The issue this week really was a great build-up, and in the previous week's book, we had the wonderful back-and-forth between Sinestro and Hal, where Sinestro just basically takes him to school. And this issue drives it home with a few panels particularly, where Hal just cold cocks Sinestro, drops him on his butt, and while he's standing over him, he is pointing his finger saying, "Don't you think you're better than me?" And Sinestro just sort of looks at him cockeyed, laughs in his face, and goes, "Jordan, I am better than you, and you know it. Now come on, stop playing around, let's go." And Hal just sort of hangs his head and flies off behind him like, "Yes, Dad." Which, that moment I thought was really pretty good. It's another interesting change to the character where I don't think the Hal Jordan previously would have ever taken that crap. But because of his current situation now, he kind of has to. Moving on to the ending though, with what happens, it really does leave it open to what are they going to do with this? It's such an obvious, okay, something is going to happen now, with any foreshadowing or indication of what it might be. So I really think that the issue next month, I think will sort of be the big hook. I think number four is going to be the book that people will judge the rest of the series by. They're either going to love number four and they're going to stick with Green Lantern all the way through, or they're going to read number four, they're not going to like what happens, and that's going to be it. They'll drop it. They're not going to continue giving it the benefit of the doubt through the rest of the arc. That's my prediction. That's what I think is going to happen. What do you think?
I can certainly agree that it will kind of make or break the story arc. And, yeah, with Hal entering the battery, you know, it brings up a myriad of what did happen. You know, was this something that Sinestro didn't plan on happening? Was this Sinestro laying a trap for Hal to finally get rid of his enemy? Which, it's a really well thought out plan, and he's been a perfect actor throughout this entire thing if that's what it is. If he did this just to get rid of Hal, he certainly laid out a path and acted masterfully to get him there. Now, at the end of this, you know, I'm kind of wondering, Hal's in the middle, in the power battery, and many moons ago, you may remember of another entity that was trapped inside of the Green Lantern's battery, which prevented it from being able to affect yellow light. The yellow impurity, which turned out to be Parallax. Is Hal Jordan the new Parallax? Is he going to be an impurity in the yellow ring, causing it to not work against green? So, that's just my thought. I have no idea where this story is actually going to go, but that was one of the things that occurred to me.
I guess that would make him Ion instead of Parallax, though, wouldn't it?
Well, but he's not quite Ion either. I was referring to Parallax simply because that was the first entity that we knew of, and it was the one that was trapped inside the Green Lantern battery.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ion being the avatar of the Green Lantern Corps, Parallax being the avatar of the Yellow Lantern Corps. So it's going to be rather interesting to see that now that is Hal trapped inside there? Is he disintegrated? Is he going to become an entire being made of yellow light or yellow and green light? There's a myriad of ways that this could go. I want to see where it's going to be, and hopefully this won't turn into the Clone Saga.
Don't worry about Clone Saga. We'll get to that a little bit later. the next book from DC this week is Suicide Squad, of course, number three as well. Suicide Squad, just as a quick overview, is the story of a group of villains that have been hired by the government as a black ops team in the blackest of black ops.
I wouldn't say hired so much as forced against their will.
Drafted. I think they are appropriate
to be. They get paroled early if they follow orders and survive. Of course,
yeah, it's the survive part that's really kind of the clincher, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called Suicide Squad for a reason. Not to mention the fact that Amanda Waller or anybody else that she determines has a little switch to blow them up, you know, in the middle of a mission. So,
but not all of them, as we found out near the end of this issue. But boy, good to know what you thought about it.
Yeah. I did enjoy this. I think Adam Glass is finding the voices of the characters and starting to get better at writing the characters and this book. So I think it's, you know, he's got his arc. He's starting to stretch it out and move forward with it. And yeah, we've definitely seen some redshirted ensigns as people are getting carted off and injured and new people coming in. It'll certainly be interesting to see how well they can keep that up. A march of redshirted ensigns. Yeah. They look, even in South Park, they finally said, "Oh my God, you killed Kenny," got old, and they stopped doing it. So it's the perfect book for just bringing in a character, killing him. Maybe if they brought in a number of secondhand characters, start rotating through them regularly, depending on the type of mission and what skills are needed, so that when one of them comes back, you're not automatically assuming that they're the person going to die. And let's face it, when the away team beamed down and there was Spurk, and it was Spock, Captain Kirk, Bones, and a guy in a red shirt, you knew the red shirt was going to be the one that died. So,
oh, yeah,
they're doing the same thing. You know it's not going to be Harley. You know it's not going to be Deadshot. You know it's not going to be King Shark. So is going to be the one that died? Yeah. So, you know, as they rotate through characters, I think if they bring in enough, you know, you keep a core group of two or three of those, and they don't even have to be those same three every thing. You know, this time it's going to be Harley and Deadshot. You know, even if you made Deadshot the leader, okay, this time it's Harley and Deadshot. Okay, Harley's sitting this one out. We got King Shark in there, and what was the spider guy in this issue? You know, he's back.
Black Spider. Or, you
know, Black Spider or El Diablo's in there. And, okay, next mission, okay, you know, Black Spider and El Diablo are not in there, but King Shark's back. King Shark's in there and Harley's back in there. So now you're rotating out some of the main characters. You've got a field leader who's fairly constant. And you've got two or three side characters that are, you know, F-list. And especially if some of those F-listers make it back from the mission, next time you see them, maybe, you know, they're not going to, maybe they'll make it back, maybe they won't. One of the things that was rather interesting as a character turn is Harley and Deadshot getting it on. Now,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if it was just DC trying to get more sex in their books and making them edgier, in which case, come on, get over it, guys. We don't need that. However, if there was a character that this kind of worked with, I think Harley it did. I mean, Deadshot's the type of guy, it's a chick, I'll sleep with her. Yeah. But for Harley, you know, part of her... She was always after the Joker. Now that was her honey bun, her puddin'. And if he's not around, she's still got needs. Yeah. So, yeah, there was certainly something sexual that sparked that relationship between her and the Joker. Yeah. So, yeah, to see her, you know, just go after her needs, you know, certainly it's not a morals issue with her. So I'm kind of okay with it. They certainly didn't make her as bad as they did with Starfire, with the Red Hood and the Outlaws. But I think if they do start making her sleep around, you know, and certainly, you know, with Deadshot, he's like, this is a one-time thing. We did it, we're done. You know, we scratched an itch and it's over with.
Yeah.
Now, the other part of this is it could make for an interesting story arc down the line, but I don't think they're willing to kill off one or both of those characters, but if they have to fight each other at some point where they go head to head, now you've got an interesting point. Before I turn it over to you to find out what you thought, the last thing that did bug me about this book is the way it started off. And it was another one of the books that starts off, here's a scenario with people fighting. And now we're going to cut to a day earlier, or 12 hours earlier, or whatever, and show you how they got to that scenario. Well, when we left the last book, they were just told that their exfiltration had been compromised and they were stuck getting to a new landing zone and had to survive 12 hours on their own. Well, that's a pretty good situation to start a book off in. You're in the middle of a story arc. You don't need to find a hook to keep me reading in the middle of an arc. I've already picked up the next book because that's what I want to find out, is what's going to happen next. I think it's a poor device, and especially in this case, because there was no vested interest in the situation that that we were initially presented. Now, if it had started off with two of them pointing guns at each other, or in some sort of death trap where one was about to kill the other or attack the other, now I'm kind of interested, because what made these two people that are on the same team turn on each other when they're trying to get out of a hot LZ? When they're trying to get to, you know, recover and take cover under a hot LZ, that makes it interesting. Yeah. But there was none of that. It was just them in the middle of a firefight, so there's no compelling reason as to why they started off in the middle of the story arc. Justin, you agree, disagree? What's your take with Harley as well?
Well, let me jump back to what you're talking about with the red shirt issue. You and I actually, we had talked about this before the show, in that I think it would be entertaining to see them actually address it in comic as kind of a fourth wall break kind of joke, where the new guy that joins the team ends up becoming the, oh, haha, new guy, we won't see you for very long. You know, that bantering, jokey, like the wink, wink, nudge, nudge, oh, yeah, we know who's not going to survive through this mission type of thing, which they could then in turn, you know, take that assumption and play with it as well, where you have a guy that comes in that's the newbie and he ends up being a survivor and one of the mainliners gets killed that issue. So they can have some fun with that, and I really think they should examine that a little bit more.
Oh my god, you killed Kenny.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, they could say that too, but... You know, just, you know, to point the fun at it, or if,
By the time South Park was getting on to its second, third season, there's actually the point where it was like, oh my god, you killed Kenny. The characters didn't even care because they expected it anymore, and that's, I think, what you're talking about. It became the joke how they said, oh my god, you, instead of being shocked and surprised, it was just, oh, it happened again.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing, and what would be even better is if somebody joins the team and they're actually wearing a red shirt, and everybody just sort of looks at them and starts laughing, and they just leave it at that.
Yeah. So, we also might be too inside baseball on that. Yeah. And that's to say that maybe they wouldn't, that maybe. Comic book people aren't going to understand that. But the question is,
about that. I mean, Red Shirt Ensign, I think, is outside of, I mean, it's geek culture, yeah, but it's superseded that. It's become popular vernacular now. I mean, they could throw that out in an episode of The Office and it would hit home with a large enough audience. Next thing I was going to comment on is Harley. And I'm having a hard time trying to think of female characters that have been reintroduced in the New 52 that haven't slept with somebody. At least as far as the mainliners. Give her time. Hey, well, she just ran into... Nightwing and her, well, never mind. We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
We'll discuss that later.
Yeah.
But I'll discuss that.
Starfire, like you mentioned, Catwoman. I haven't read the Wonder Woman title, but I want to say she's in that boat too. So,
well, as far as the mainliners, they're giving her a boyfriend, but she's been long overdue for to have a serious boyfriend relationship. So, Wonder Woman also gets a pass on that. I think it needed to work for the characters. And to be fair, Catwoman and Batman had been a long time in happening. It was something fans had been asking about. It had been hinted at before. Starfire was just out of the blue and completely demolished any character that had been there before. Harley, it's a twist on the character. You know, and certainly there's the fact that it's not the Joker. That's what her psychosis is. But then again, if the Joker's not around, maybe... that is part of the psychosis, and that she would go with
that. I will say that her using the pet name Pumpkin on Floyd was a little bit creepy, because you could almost hear like the Fatal Attraction music starting to play in the background. It's like, oh, she's getting attached. This is not going to be good. The main reason I wanted to bring this up,
that could be where they're going with it, and if they are, I'm definitely much more okay with it. If that is kind of the way that they're going, is that her attachment and too much.
I mean, we know that she is in fact cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, so now she'll just be cuckoo for a different cereal. I don't know, Corn Pops maybe. I don't know. Anyways, the main reason I wanted to bring this back up though is because I really think that they have enough characters where this is occurring that it's coming to a point that it's becoming disruptive to the stories that they're trying to tell. If this continues to sort of pop up in these other books, I think what we're going to end up seeing is people becoming more fixated on the sexual activities of the characters and the depiction of it and just the fact that it exists in the titles, that they're going to get distracted away from the story that it's supposed to be about in the first place. So my personal plea to DC is, okay, guys, you've made your point. We now understand where you guys are coming from. Get on with the story. Leave this in the back. You can, you know, if you want, sprinkle it in your books here and there, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to be one to say don't, but let's try to minimize it out a bit and get back to the stories, which is what's important. So
maybe that's that, actually where they're going with this. It could very well be that they're just trying to go, okay, let's get some of the, you know, the fans want Catwoman and Batman to sleep together. Let's get it out of the way and it's done. Now, they've wanted Wonder Woman to have a boyfriend, get it out of the way, it's done. Well, Harley sleep with somebody other than the Joker, let's get it out of the way, it's done, and now we can move on. I think part of the problem, Starfire, because it was so out of personality for what she'd been before, was certainly, the most shocking of these, and probably the most damaging. I think if they had continued their run and done all of this, I think maybe the fact that it's all together may have meant something. But if they had stretched these out, Starfire, okay, that's issue one. We got it out of the way. Yeah. 5 issues from now, it was Catwoman. And then 5 issues from that, it was Harley. Yeah. So now you're, you're half the year away from when, the first event happened. Now it's spread out. It's not a pattern anymore. So we don't see it. I think because it was all as part of the relaunch, we're all seeing it. And I think you're right. If they continue with that, I don't want to buy these books to see who's having sex with who. If I wanted that, I can go turn on a soap opera on daytime television. I'm looking for the other stories. Not to say that these can't sometimes make some compelling stories. And the relationship between Dick and Barbara, when you deal with it as a relationship, can make for some compelling. If that relationship, they develop it between Harley and Deadshot, where there is an emotional link that grows between them, and they're on the Suicide Squad, are they going to compromise the mission to save one another? There's something you can actually build there and make it compelling. And if they do that, I'm willing to let this slide and be good with this. I think the fact that it's all happened at once, and maybe that's because it's the relaunch, maybe it's because they're trying to reshape some of these characters and create that, maybe it's because they're trying to feel edgy. Yeah, I think it's because it's all at once that we're really seeing, DC turn all its women into sluts. And to be fair, the guys are sleeping around too. So,
it's not just the women, the guys are sluts too. Let me hit one last thing on this, and then I want to move on, the other possibility of why this could be done this way, and I'm going to reference Neil Gaiman, who wrote American Gods. In that novel, he actually made some of his most shocking and weird out there prose in the first 2 chapters. His reasoning being, if the readers could get past that and continue to want to read the story, then they were the type of reader that would enjoy that story. It was sort of like, shaking off the loose fruit, which might be kind of the same idea of what they're going with here. DC's throwing this stuff out to begin with so that the people that really do have a problem with that type of story aren't going to continue with it, because there'll be adult enough themes in that story comparable to, the free love, if you want to put it that way.
I think it's a bad thing for them to have done that if that is what they're doing. And I don't think it is, because they want to grow their reader base. They want to build back, win back some of those people that they've lost. Maybe they feel, being edgier will do that, and that's why they've done it. But if they're just trying to get rid of that loose fruit that isn't going to enjoy those types of stories, I think they've narrowed their focus of their books too much. That's not what these books are about, or at least what people, I think, are looking for these books to be about. So I think they're trying to get rid of people that they want to read. If that was their point, they're getting rid of people that they would have wanted to read these books, and they're bringing the books in the wrong direction.
Yeah, if they want to make the stories edgier, they want to do something to to make people want to read these edgier books, then if they're getting rid of readership, yeah, I mean, that's counter to what their ultimate goal is. They should be adjusting the stories to not be as edgy as opposed to trying to shape their reader base into what the writers want to do. But enough on that. We spent enough time talking about sex and comics. So I'm going to go ahead and jump over and talk about a couple other DC titles real quick. Coming out this week from the Dark Line was both Grifter and Resurrection Man, both of these, of course, number three as well. Grifter has been good. This issue had a, as I'm calling it, a thick, chewy dose of cliche. There were a whole lot of just, like, really kind of hokey, oh, really, that's where you're going with it kind of things. But even with that in there, there was enough other spice and other interesting tidbits to the story that were around it that you didn't really mind when the cliche got stuck in your throat. So, kind of like a really big oyster on a cracker with horseradish and cocktail sauce and lemon juice and butter. You know, it's got all the good stuff around it that you don't really notice that it's like eating a big slimy booger. So, Grifter was a big slimy booger this month. That's my review. A well-spiced, big, slimy booker.
But you did like
that's fantastic. A glowing review if ever I've heard one. Resurrection Man was a really, really good issue as well. I don't particularly care for the body doubles villain that they're putting him against right now. However, this month's issue reminded me a lot, again, going back to Gaiman. I don't know why he seems to be such a hot topic with me this week. There was a graphic novel, a Sandman graphic novel, or excuse me, this wasn't Gaiman, I apologize, I take that back. It was actually a Constantine, it was a Constantine graphic novel called Empathy is the Enemy. And it had this neat sort of, you know, there's heaven and hell, and then there's what's in between, and the exploration of that concept in Empathy for the Enemy. And they are doing that as well in Resurrection Man, so I really kind of like where this is going, the whole idea of it's not just, you know, above and below that's fighting over his soul. It's also this middle ground that wants him just as bad. So for whatever reason, his soul has a great big shining neon sign on it that says, come and get me. And they're trying. And they're continuing to try, which is, I think, what's making it more entertaining than anything else. Polio, what did you have in DC titles for this week?
The other two Batman titles that I read were Batman and Robin and Batgirl. And as we previously mentioned, Batgirl has yet to be sleeping around. This was a wonderful exploration of the character, and she's reacting to having her legs back. You know, back in the old DC, you know, they, you know, had Barbara was shot in the back by the Joker. It was a paraplegic. As I started this off, she now has her legs, and the people around her are starting to realize that she's going back out and is being Batgirl again. So there's the realization from her father in issue two, actually maybe the end of issue one or issue two, where he's told Batgirl's back. And he realizes that that's horrible. Let's face it, it's his daughter. He knows who she is. And then this one was interesting because Nightwing shows up, and Nightwing, Dick Grayson, has been a love interest for Batgirl. Back when she first showed up on the scene, they had a fling, and you know, they of course grew up together as Batgirl and Robin, Boy Wonder. So there's a whole history there, and they go back, and Gail starts to examine the feelings and the emotions, the crush that she had on him, the crush that Batgirl had on Robin, or you know, that Barbara had on Dick, however you want to view that whole relationship. So it's a wonderful look on, you know, Dick showing up and saying, hey, I'm worried for you. You know, whatever you had that got you your legs back, which they haven't quite revealed what it was, if you push yourself too hard, it will be reversed. You will lose the use of your legs if you're pushing yourself too hard. And it's one thing to say that to a person who's getting up and walking around because they're going, you know, they want to walk around Disney for the day. Now, if you've ever been to Disney, you know it's a lot of walking to walk all the way around the park to every ride that you're going to get on and standing in line. It's one thing to tell them that. But when you got somebody who's going and swinging from rooftop to rooftop, jumping on runaway trains, you know, and fighting people, that's even more taxing. So, you know, to see how she's dealing with the people around her, how she's pushing the people around her that love her and are trying to look out for her, how she's pushing them away, is a wonderful insight to the story. And the villain who's been in the arc of this since the beginning is Mirror. And so it starts off...
Is that a new villain?
Yeah, Mirror is a new villain. So okay. You get this wonderful of Mirror who has survivor guilt. And you're kind of seeing some of the things that Barbara feels mirrored from the Mirror. It's a very apt villain there. And, yeah. But he has this wonderful little thing where he's going after, a survivor who was, had passed out on the elevated train tracks that go through Gotham and was rescued by a Good Samaritan. He says, and Mirror's MO is that he's going around and killing the people that survived accidents they should have been killed in. So Batgirl goes to save this guy, only to find out that Mirror wasn't after the person who survived that accident. He actually went after the Samaritan that saved the person. He felt that the Samaritan was the one that had sinned by allowing the person to live and blew up the train, which is a wonderful twist, and I've just completely spoiled that part of the story, but I'm sure Gail's got a lot of stuff in store for us, as she examines this character and as Barbara goes to take down. So you've got, Batgirl thinking, I figured it out. I'm going to stop this guy. I know his MO. I'm going to keep him from doing what he was going to do. And she fails. And there's one other part in this book, which I think everybody that reads it can probably relate to. She goes in and visits her father at work. And you see this whole bit of dialogue of her saying, of Batgirl, Barbara explaining, this is what's been going bad in my life. I've got my legs back and I'm worried that I'm working too hard and that I'm going to, ruin them. My roommate hasn't paid their share of the rent. And I've got, this guy Mirror who, is a villain, and I was right there when he blew up the train. And instead of saying that to her father, she says, I just wanted to go get lunch with you. I'm sure we've all kind of felt that way, where we've got this whole list of things that are bothering us and bugging us, and we want that person we can confide in. But for her, it was her dad, that she can't do it. We've got that thing that we want to tell somebody, and it's like, I just can't do it. So I really felt, there's a lot of emotion throughout this book in particular. Gail's doing a wonderful job, and the art by Adrian Saif is just beautiful. That was just one of the Bat books I read, the other book being Batman and Robin. And this is completely different relationship with characters, as Damian, the current Robin, is very intent on not following what Bruce wants him to do, and is actually quite upset when Bruce, for the third time in a row, goes on patrol without him. Bruce, who has said, I'm very proud of you, I'm glad that you're able to control yourself and you've been very disciplined in that you haven't put people in the hospital, you're not completely beating the pulp out of people when we go out on parole, but you gotta stay home today. So Damian decides that he's tired of being restrained and goes out on his own and winds up finding two muggers and beating the living hell out of them. So it really is building this rift. How is Damian going to grow up? Damian thinks he's older than he is. He's been raised by assassins. Is he going to follow the path laid out by his grandfather, Ra's al Ghul? Or is he going to be following the path that his father, Batman, is trying to teach him of restraint? The character of Damian is really being told. This is really a study of Damian as Robin, more so than it is of Batman. But it is about, because of it's the study of Robin, it's the study of the relationship between Batman and Robin, which is great for this title. There was one thing that really kind of irked me, is Damian at one point is playing a game of chess with Alfred, and he goes, Alfred, you're not going to beat me. My mom used to, kidnap Grandmaster chess players to play me, and I always won. And then Alfred beats him in chess. So it could also be just she's boasting. Yeah. But if that was a statement of fact, it certainly is one of those things where, really, Alfred beat him? And not to take anything away from Alfred, he's actually one of my favorite characters. But, you know, if Damien is proposing to be as badass as he is, maybe that's the whole point of the scene. Maybe I kind of read it wrong. Maybe the point is that Damien isn't as good as he thinks he is. Yeah, that the butler beat him. Then again, it wouldn't surprise me that Alfred is also a grandmaster at chess. But it still would be driving point the point home that, yeah, Damien isn't as good as he thinks he is. And I think that's something that we're probably going to see throughout this series. So,
out of curiosity's sake, what was it that made Damien join up with Bruce in the first place? Was it his choice? Was it Talia? Was it circumstance? Like, how did he end up there in the first place?
Talia felt that he needed to be with his dad and learn from his dad. So she dumped him off with Bruce. And so it was actually rather interesting timing because it was right at the point before Bruce Wayne disappeared from Infinite Crisis and they had the battle for the cowl, which was actually a better thing for Damien. And it's actually rather interesting on how they're doing this because Damien went from being the character that is actually very much portrayed as in the Batman and Robin comic book now to learning how to work with people under Dick, because Dick is much more of a people person when he went from being Nightwing to taking on the mantle of the Bat. Yeah. He was a much better equipped person for breaking Damien out of that shell that he was in, that hardened case of being trained as an assassin, and that human life is worthless, and there is no compassion. So Dick did a much better job, and I don't think Bruce would have been able to work with Damien had Dick not done that initial groundwork. That's one of the things that they left open with right before Bruce disappeared from being Batman during Final Crisis, mm-hmm. is, you know, he wasn't able to get along with Damien and would have probably thrown him out and gotten rid of him as not worth the trouble. So the fact that he disappeared and Dick took over, I think, is really what has allowed this book. And it seems like Damien's done a little bit of a backslide since he is working with Bruce, which probably isn't surprising given Bruce's normal demeanor. So, yeah, but overall...
Grouch.
Yeah, grouch is one way of putting it. No, it's good, though, and it'll be interesting to see because they are kind of hinting that Damien might be wanting to overthrow Bruce. Yeah, maybe not overthrow is probably the wrong term, but certainly rebel against him and go his own way. So we'll have to see.
Oh, you mean he's going to be Damien. A teenager?
Yeah, be a teenager.
Which, that's always kind of been the Batman and Robin book idea, is you have the adult, the experienced, the veteran, and you have the young, brash, inexperienced, very talented, but very stiffly independent, wanting to go out and make their own name, which, let's face it, I mean, that's every human being on this planet has gone through that. So it's, I think the book as a whole is the study of that particular point in a relationship, especially with a parent-son or parent-child relationship.
Yeah, and it's been a different relationship each time. I mean, Dick certainly revolted against Bruce, but that was more of a, you're smothering me, I need some freedom. You know, I can, you know, make my own decisions. I am my own man. Revolt. You know. And, you know, and Jason Todd never really fully got to that point as they killed him off well before then. He certainly was revolting,
so.
But he'd also been living on the skiff. And actually, Damien is very similar to Jason Todd, probably most so because Jason had been living on the street, had been used to surviving on his own and doing for himself. So when somebody came in and started telling him what to do, he wasn't used to it and was rebelling because he's not used to being told what to do and how to act.
That would be an interesting story to see, actually, would be Jason Todd finding Damien and basically telling him, hey, look, man, this doesn't work. I tried it. It will get you killed. I don't see Damian being very open to it. He'd probably see it as, yeah, you just weren't good enough. And then having Jason Dock beat the ever-loving piss out of him, because that would just be entertaining in itself. But
that did happen, actually. As the Red Hood.
With Jason the tire, well, I was going to say with the tire iron, but yeah, that did happen in Battle for the Cowl, didn't it?
Yeah. But and then, of course, lastly, you have Tim Drake, who actually sought out Batman and wanted that experience of being the apprentice to Batman. And so he did not have that rebellion, that having to fight against Bruce. And he certainly had his own ideas and said, no, I don't agree with that. But he was much more willing to bend to Bruce's will. And at that point, Bruce had already had two apprentices and seen and learned ways to work
with him. Didn't have to have that fight with Bruce either, because he was having that fight already with his own father just by being Robin in the first place, which his dad didn't want him to be.
Right. So, yeah, it certainly, you know, has had its own, and it does make for some compelling storytelling to see those relationships build and change.
I'm going to hit the gas here and push on to the next topic. Speaking of teenagers and teenage angst and rebellion, Ultimate Spider-Man number 4 also came out this week, and thank goodness, finally, after 4 issues, we are finally getting to see Miles Morales in a Spider-Man costume for the first time in 4 issues. What was that?
It's the wrong costume.
Yeah, it's the wrong costume, but at least he's in a costume. He's in something. We are finally seeing a Spider-Man. You know, so that in itself is a nice little, yay, finally. This issue deals a lot with the revelation of why Miles is going to choose to become Spider-Man. We already know he has the powers. We already know he's aware of Peter Parker. And at the end of issue 3 was the announcement that Peter Parker had been, or excuse me, that Spider-Man had been shot or was being killed. Miles actually goes to the scene of Peter Parker's death that was shown at the end of the previous Ultimate Spider-Man run. And I feel like his reasoning for taking up the Spider-Man mantle is a little bit on the flimsy side. I think his logic is flawed. Regardless of his feelings towards it, I think he thinks he has a strong enough emotional reasoning for doing it. I'm just having a hard time following his logic. I get it. I mean, I do get his logic. I just don't feel like it's the same. You wouldn't get the same drive out of it that Peter got out of the death of his uncle, out of the death of, you know, his caretaker, the person who, you know, loved him unconditionally. Being responsible for that death is very different from being feeling responsible, not being obviously directly responsible, but feeling responsible for the death of a person that you don't know other than through the fact of knowing that they are a hero. So that's my take on it. I may be in the minority as far as that opinion goes, but Jason, what do you think?
I think you're right. It does feel a little weak. It was a wonderful way of passing the torch. And when he shows up and he talks with, I believe it's Gwen Stacy, she says, you know, he did it because of what his uncle told him. Great power comes great responsibility. Yeah, they got it in the book. So there's certainly that passing of the torch. But, yeah, I don't see... If they'd have kind of set this up that Miles was a huge Spider-Man fan, like his walls are decorated with Spider-Man, he's buying comic books based on Spider-Man, he's got news clippings hung up. If that was Miles and this had happened, now there's an emotional connection. It's now he's got these spider powers and he didn't use them. That's what they tried to establish. It's like, I had these spider powers. I could have gone and fought with Spider-Man and helped, and maybe he would still be alive. And I think he may, the character I think may be a bit too young to even have him go out there. Marvel is really the Aether Universe very young recently. But
that's true.
Yeah, to see him, yeah, with a lot of the X-Men titles and this, you know, they're really getting young characters, and I'm, you know, wondering just how young do they need these characters to be? Yeah, to the point that it's almost ridiculous how young they are.
Are they trying to hook a younger audience with it or something?
I don't know if they're going for a younger audience. They're, you know, right kind of, you know, I'm trying to figure out if this is like a junior high that Miles is in. Yeah. Maybe it's
prep school, so yeah, I would say it's like a middle school, junior high, would be my guess.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. So it just seems too young to be wanting to do this. I mean, Peter was at least in high school, probably, you know, late sophomore year, probably. You know, at least that's kind of where I picture it when he got his powers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it does work for pulling in that younger audience. You know, maybe they just want to have that younger people to give them more room to grow in their sliding time scale. Yeah, but back to the book, you know, I think the connection there was real tentative, like you said. You know, it was wonderful as far as a story point to see how he gets out of the school to go see the scene of Peter's death, and, you know, going to the funeral, you know, skipping out to go to the funeral and seeing the family and how they're reacting, and have that kind of strike a chord with them. But it wasn't quite powerful enough. And I think you're right. There probably is something coming with his family that will really kind of tweak it. And yeah, as I pointed out, he's wearing a Halloween costume of the Peter Parker Spider-Man when he finally puts on his costume in here, as opposed to the costume they've been showing on the cover of the books for the past four issues. Which, right. Then again, I do kind of wonder, you know, where is he going to get the costume? I mean, he's in high school. Where is it coming from? So, but that wasn't the only book that we read this week from Marvel. So
no. We both also picked up Incredible Hulk number 1. This came out, I think, actually it was last week. I think was the drop date for this. Author was Jason Aaron. Artist is Mark Silvestri. Hang on a second. Silvestri. I want to make sure I said that right. Whose art I really, really enjoy. I love all the stuff that he's done for Top Cow. I'm a big fan of the Witchblade books. I'm a big fan of Darkness. The Darkness more so, because I find not even so much the character, but the Darkness itself and the little Darklings to be some of the funniest characters in comics. Because this was a number one book, there wasn't a whole lot to it. This is occurring after the end of Fear Itself, where in the postlog of the story, we see Banner and the Hulk actually split completely into two separate beings. And the Hulk basically, you know, wipes his chin at Banner and splits. So this is now following the Hulk and what's happened with him since then. Even for a number one, I think it was a little bit light on exposition. There wasn't really a whole lot going on other than a little bit of brooding and a little bit of fighting. The artwork, I have to say, for Silvestri in general, it's not some of his best work. He's done much, much better. But that being said, it's still probably some of the best art that came out that entire week anyways. Even on his bad day, he's better than many, many other authors. He's one of the few guys that from the late 90s and early 2000s, he, like many, were aping Jim Lee's style, and he's one of the ones, I think, that really got it right, where he was able to take a lot of stuff that Jim Lee was doing and then make it his own and do good stuff with it. Personally, I feel that McFarlane falls into that category, too, because the three of them, I think, all had that same kind of sketchy, thin line style art that works really well in comics. And these three did it really well. There's other artists out there that I won't mention, although I have a feeling most people will probably figure out who I'm talking about, who didn't get it right and usually had problems, you know, omitting body parts like necks and elbows. But my overall feeling for this book was good art, lack of story, and I'm not really that enthused to see where it goes. Jason, what did you think?
I am enthused to see where this goes. I think it was a huge setup, and yeah, there's a bunch of stuff working here at different levels. Again, Mark's art is great, and yeah, just to see the Hulk drawn by him is a lot of fun. Yeah, and but the setup in the story that Jason Aaron has done, yeah, I think we're gonna see some big things occurring. I mean, you didn't really touch on what's going on. Hulk and Bruce are now two separate entities. They're actually two physical bodies. It's not, you know, one body that morphs into the Hulk or one body that has both minds in it or even a third mind, which was the Gray Hulk at one point. Now, they're now two separate entities. There's the Hulk and there's Banner. And Banner has lost it. And he's apparently on an island where he has captured all of the wildlife and is gamma mutating it. So we've got gamma mutated human. Yeah, it is. It's, you know, human mutated pigs or hogs. You know, you've got monkeys. Yeah, it's, and he's done it to everything on this island trying to find the Hulk. So he's apparently not just lost his mind, but lost part of himself. The Hulk is part of him. It was that anger that you always feel inside you when somebody makes you angry and you always just want to just smash out and hit him and you can't. That was always the Hulk part of Bruce, and it's gone. Meanwhile, Hulk has found what he's always wanted, something that he had back when they banished him from Earth when he became the emperor of the planet. You know, he, you know, had found peace. He found a society that accepted him, that looked up to him, that felt he was as much of a gain to them as he was to be able to just relax where he was. He was in this new society, he's the great hunter. He comes back with food for everybody, and they celebrate and worship him as that. Back on planet Hulk, he fought his way up, became the emperor of the planet. Was the one that everybody looked up to. He freed the slaves, had found a wife that had made him a child. Yeah. So he found a very similar life to what he had on Planet Hulk and was really enjoying that when, you know, Avon Doom shows up. Now, apparently there's no relation to Victor Von Doom, the infamous Dr. Doom, but somebody's shown up in mechanical armor, shows up fighting for some odd reason, which I can only think, well, the character does admit, I did that, you know, not knowing how you would react. Really, rather, so you come in guns blazing as opposed to trying to ask the person that you're trying to have help you for help?
I think it was just an excuse to get action.
Kind of like she's doing it to get his attention, and I think the way she put it was to show you that we mean business. Knowing that, like, coming in knowing it wouldn't necessarily do anything, but it was sort of like a very solid tap on the shoulder.
I think it was an excuse to get some action into the book. I think anybody that's smart would not be coming in guns a-blazing. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess you want the Hulk's attention, you come up doing his zen kind of thing.
Yeah. But I think there's certainly room for this to grow. What's going to happen with Banner? What's happening with Hulk? Is there a Gray Hulk somewhere? So I want to see where this goes. And it certainly intrigues me much more than Red.
Yeah, I do have to admit that seeing Banner in his kooky state really, and granted, he's never exactly been the most, you know, mentally stable individual in the first place, but seeing him just going off the deep end just kind of made me smirk with anticipation.
Say it, say it, say it!
Patient.
Alright, that was bad.
Well, what other Marvel books did you read this week?
Okay. Other Marvel books for me? We had one other book that we both read. And I felt it was kind of meh. I'm not sure how you felt, but I know you kind of liked the way that the series is going. But that was Ghost Rider. To me, for me, it was very repetitive. You know, the character was just, you know, explaining the same thing over and over again. I was, I, Maybe they were taking vengeance on me and telling me that she had the demon that she was talking to that was leading her to the next person that needed to be punished. But you said it once. I didn't need it five more times in the book.
Yeah.
I kind of like the monster of the week. Yeah, you talk about the monster of the week, and in this case, it's more of an origin story for the new host of Ghost Rider, in that we get to meet her dad and then kill her dad. But I didn't really quite see where the vengeance, for the spirit of vengeance was coming in. It didn't quite grab me, and this was a kind of a new beginning, I'm guessing, for being five issues in with the new spirit, so, or at least the new host of the spirit.
The first four issues occurred during the Fear Itself storyline, so I think this issue really should have been tagged as kind of like a number one. It's introducing Alejandra as the host for the Ghost Rider, and I think a lot of people may have missed those first four books because they saw them with the Fear Itself branding on it, and they may have just flat out skipped it. So they used this number five to give you the full recap, you know, the full introduction to the character and to the powers and all the stuff about her. So that's my guess. I think that's why they're doing this. I do really like the Monster of the Month thing. I hope they continue to do that. We don't really see that style of storytelling in comics anymore. Everything now is the six-issue arc. It's all about getting the collection and putting it into something that can be a trade to go out. If they do a simple month-to-month book where it's, here's the monster this week, boom, got it, nailed it, done. And have another one next week. You can still collect those together into a trade. It doesn't have to be this cohesive story arc over six issues. Just give me a collection of six good books, you know, six good one-shot stories. I'd be just as happy with that. I hope they go.
I did enjoy the fact that it was a one-and-done.
A breath of fresh air.
I do like that it's a one-and-done, and certainly having a series of books that are one-and-done will be a nice change from what most of the books out there are doing. Now, they're doing something similar with Captain America and Bucky. At least they had been with the World War II story arc they were doing. They were one-and-done stories that were all done, set in the same time period following Bucky. So you could have picked up any one of those and it was an individual complete story. So, but they still kind of fit together in that World War II timeline. Hopefully we'll see that when they do the Winter Soldier story arc that they're about to begin in Captain America, but I certainly understand and why you would like that in Ghost Rider. And it didn't quite do it for me. I think part of it was Rob Williams' writing style, in that I felt it was very repetitive. It's one thing if they explain it at the beginning of the book for the people that are picking the book up after Fear Itself and don't know who she is, what she's doing, and how she does it. But they didn't get into, you know, the depth of, you know, Venice, like the penance stare. And you know, if they'd have done some of that, it felt like they were kept repeating that, you know, she's the spirit of vengeance. She's got this other demon that's in there with her. She follows that demon because it's going to lead her to people that need to pay. That kept being repeated throughout it. You know, it was too much repetition for me to be able to enjoy that. But, there were other Marvel books that I did enjoy. This week, I picked up Wolverine and the X-Men after reading Uncanny X-Men. I was really interested to see where they were going with the other side of the X-Men team. And this book actually came out last month. I finally was able to pick it up, you know, from after my interest with Uncanny and the fact that they finally had it in the store. So I picked this up. And I enjoyed it. There was certainly an interesting tact on seeing Wolverine, you know, and Kitty Pryde as the headmasters of the new Jean Grey School for Gifted Children, the mutant school. I'm not sure exactly the full title, but it's named after Jean Grey, which, you know, in part is probably a shot at Scott, since that Wolverine and Scott had been fighting over Jean romantically for a long time. Certainly it's a shot with, you know, to remind Scott of what they had been in the past under Xavier, it opens up with Wolverine talking with Xavier and kind of that passing of the torch, which was nice to see. And, you know, Xavier going, this is no longer my thing, it's yours. What's interesting is, as they're opening the school, it's the first day of school, so you're starting to see some of the classes, and it introduces you, which is great for an opening one, number one book, introducing you to the building and what it's capable of and some of the changes that they've made with it. And they're giving a tour to the Board of Education, who's trying to certify this school as being ready. Unfortunately, I felt like it kind of devolved into an episode of Friends, which I know a lot of people like that show. I was not a fan because I felt they dumbed the characters down to serve the plot as opposed to making the plot serve the characters. The characters would have something go on and would purposely screw it up to make the joke, to make something bad happen so that they could move forward. You know, the writers would have the character say the wrong thing when it's not what the character would be saying in that situation, or you know, even more to the point, not the character that would be presented in that situation. No. If you know somebody's screwed up, you don't bring somebody that you're trying to impress to go talk to that person. It's not like they didn't know the Board of Education was coming to investigate the school. They most certainly could have and would have put together this fully competent tour. They would have pulled, Hank out from working on trying to resolve everything and sat him down that was one of the things. They really didn't have to. He would have known that they were coming and would have been prepared. You know, even with the things falling apart at the school that he was working on, there are iterated throughout this of earthquakes and lava appearing in the school. So, Hank is trying to work on that as well as trying to get the systems back up and online. The whole school is now a danger room, so they're trying to work on that. There's all sorts of things that Hank is working on, but he's going to stop that and pay attention to what's going on when the Board of Education comes to the room. That's the realistic expectation to happen.
Yeah, you're not going to have as many facepalm moments as they would have otherwise.
There were a lot of facepalm moments, and I think Jason Aaron was trying to get a sense of comedy in here, as well as set up the calamity of the school board not approving the school. I'm wondering if the school board was just a way of him showing us through the school and some of the changes, or if their school board is actually going to have some sort of future role with the school. I hope it does. Of them saying, no, this is not a safe environment to kids. We have to shut it down. And certainly the school board shows up being anti-mutant. So it's certainly on their agenda to try and find ways of shutting the school down, or at least it appears that way. So hopefully that's a continuing story arc that we'll see. The book is set up that it very well should be. I hope it just wasn't a poor excuse to try and bring some comedy into this book and show us around the school. And they do bring in the Hellfire Club and talk about what they did for Schism as the new Black King shows up and talks to Logan briefly right before the end of the book, when what appears to be a giant dinosaur comes out of the earth, hence all the discussion of magma and earthquakes previously. So they did kind of foreshadow something big was happening at the end. It looks like it's a giant rock dinosaur coming out of the earth. Could be fun. Maybe that's what's going to cause the Board of Education to change their mind when the X-Men save them. I'm not positive where this is going to go. It seemed like they were just trying to have some sort of a big surprise ending. A lot of this seemed forced. And as for the art, I think I'm not a fan of Chris Pachalo's art in this. It's not that it's bad. I don't think it fits. It felt like it belonged in an Archie comic. It was very rounded, kind of cartoony. It didn't feel, appropriate for the book, at least in my case. But I'm sure there's somebody out there that really liked it. Somebody obviously made the decision to put Jason Aaron and Chris Pachalo together on this book. Somebody obviously likes his art and liked it for this style of book. Maybe they felt that it would complement the comedy that Jason was trying to write in here. I didn't appreciate it. The only thing that I did laugh at was one of the extras at the back of the book. This was a $3.99 book. For the extra dollar, they did make it worth it because it was almost all extra story pages. I let them write, you know, an extra half issue of story, which is great for a first book coming out. They also at the end had a similar org chart for the Wolverine side of the setup, which was essentially the staff of the school and the students of the school. They do actually bring in a representative of the Shi'ar Empire, which, you know, they mentioned that they're using Shi'ar tech throughout the school. So there's going to be something coming from that. There is a member of the Brood who is a mutant brood, and Wolverine has said, nope, he's staying. Yeah, they already kind of had some students making trouble with him because he's not a mutant, he's an alien. But he's a mutation of that alien race. So Wolverine's like, hey, we're going to keep him. Yeah, he's a student here because he's a mutant.
And he's been a member on the team for a while already, hasn't he? Because he was part of New Mutants, right?
I didn't read New Mutants. I couldn't speak to that. I'd have to check and get back to you for sure on that one. But, yeah, they certainly make fun of the fact that, you know, Wolverine is headmaster. Who saw that one coming? And the last little bit, you know, they did have a sneak preview like they did in Uncanny of things that you're potentially going to see in the future if they are able to write the stories that they are thinking they're going to write now. But lastly, there was a little flyer at the back of the book giving all the classes you can take at the Jean Grey Institute. There's also the JeanGrayschool.com, I believe, is the website they give you for the flyer. So I'm going to have to check that out at some point, see if they actually did something with that or if they just had it on the phone. But the classes are kind of funny. World History, 1880 to 1950, a eyewitness view taught by Logan. Yeah. Some stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. So they're certainly taking, you know, the characters, you know, ordinary objects as weapons taught by Gambit. So that was funny to see the little list of classes that were being taught. Otherwise, I felt a lack of jokes and humor. But the setup is a pretty good setup, and I want to see where X-Men is going to go with where Wolverine and the X-Men is going to go. Wolverine is headmaster. There's something wrong with that.
Yeah.
But the file says, you know, best there is at what we do. That's how I felt about it. Justin, I don't think you read any other Marvel books this week, did you?
No, that's all I had. I did have a couple other things from a few of the other major publishers, but before I get into these, I do want to comment. Most of our listeners at home obviously can't see us. We're not doing a video recording, but I would like to comment that, sir, you have a fantastic mustache adorning your face at the moment. And
thank you, sir.
And I would like to point out to all of our listeners that we are, in fact, in the month of Movember. That's right. It is Movember with an M-O. Movember.com, for those of you who don't know, is a website that focuses on changing the face of men's health. Its purpose is to bring light to, specifically, prostate and testicular cancer in men. For any of you who don't know, the statistics tell us that 1 in 4 men will actually die of cancer, which I find to be an absolutely staggering number. And I just wanted to give a quick shout out to the Movember.com website and to the things that they do. Jason is, in fact, has his mustache. I am growing mine for this month to show my support in changing the face of men's health and to get men talking about their health and about making sure they see the doctor, get your annual checkups, get the things checked that you should be getting checked for your appropriate age. Because, let's face it, guys, we don't necessarily talk about our health too much. It's kind of boring. We don't want to tell each other about the, you know, weird, odd-shaped thing growing on our backside. Now, cuts, bruises, you know, the interesting things, those are fine, but the actual health things we don't necessarily talk about. So, if you get the chance, check out Movember.com and, by all means, go see your doctor, goddammit. Need to get it done anyways.
Unfortunately, ignoring it does not make the problem go away. When you're dealing with things like cancer, it just makes it worse. Yeah. I mean, you look back at Steve Jobs, who recently passed away. he has even, you know, said in his biography, he said to his biographer that he should have gone in for surgery sooner to remove the cancer. They caught it early enough and he didn't go in. He tried some other alternate methods. So knowing what you're dealing with and getting it taken care of quickly is important when dealing with cancer, whether it's, you know, pancreatic cancer or prostate cancer, testicular cancer. And women have an advantage in that they're willing to go see their doctor if they have a health problem. They're much more willing to go talk to somebody about this than men are. So guys, you know, stop being stubborn. It's not manly to just ignore the problems. If you think you got something, go talk to a doctor, get annual checkups, and you'll be around to read a lot more comics that way. So.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And speaking of, Image Comics this week had issue number, issue number three of their new series, Pigs. Pigs dealing with some children of Soviet KGB agents set in Cuba during the time of, or placed in Cuba during the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I really am liking where this story is going. There's one member of the group who doesn't really want to be there, and it's showing the backstory of how these children were trained and how even the parents didn't necessarily always feel like doing this to their kids was the right thing to do, but then how others of the group saw that as weakness, and now how we have one of the children of these operatives is in fact feeling that same way. He has grown up. He had a life in Miami, a wife and kids, and he doesn't necessarily want to be part of this. And so the sort of like sneaky infighting within the group while they're still going about this mission really is making this a very interesting title. Plus, I want to say that in this issue specifically, it is the best two closing pages of a comic book of this week. It's a humorous moment. It's a hilarious moment. I think guys will get a bigger laugh out of it than girls. Personally speaking, that's what I think. That's
You did show it to me, and it is quite funny, actually.
There you go. The other one I wanted to hit on is from IDW, the Dungeons & Dragons Legend of Drizzt comic. It's still Drizzt. It's still fantastic. I'm hoping that they'll be able to take some of the things that are occurring in this storyline with regards to characters and events and be able to work them into the Neverwinter game being developed by Wizards of the Coast that is set to come out late next year. It would be really kind of cool to be able to play that game, look at different events and stuff that's happening in it, and be able to go, oh, I know exactly what they're talking about. I know where that happened. I know where this is going, and have those kind of cool little inside jokes that a lot of times we don't get the chance to really see. Also from IDW, this didn't come up this week. This actually came out quite a few months ago, but we both finally got a chance to pick it up and read it, and that's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 2. This is the reboot of the original TMNT story. Eastman, one of the original authors, is in on the creation of this line, and it's a brand new story, a brand new origin. I mean, the origin is still basically the same. We all know the turtles and the rat, mutagen gives you Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Kung Fu Rat. That's all hasn't changed. What is changing is the point at which you're coming in the story, the origin of how they came to be in the mutagen and the development of the characters. I've been enjoying this. If for nothing else, just straight up nostalgia value. It's so fun to play around in this universe again and to see what they're doing with it and kind of toying with it this way and toying with it that way. That you see a character, you go, oh, I know exactly who that is. Okay, this is going to be fun. Let me see how they pull them into the story. I want this book. This book doesn't have to be good. This book doesn't have to be phenomenal. This book just has to be a bunch of turtles and a rat going out and kicking the crap out of people. And this issue number 2, delivers it in spades. Jason, what did you think about this?
I did enjoy this. Yeah, the fact that it has nostalgia just is icing on top of this cake. I thought there were some really interesting twists on what they did with this story. In this issue, they finally got into the spilling of the mutagen Yeah, what's probably the Foot's, you know, attempting to steal, for some reason, the Turtles and the Mutagen, and of course, when Splinter scratches one of their faces, I wonder if that's Shredder, that they all fall off the roof, the Mutagen breaks open, spills on the Turtles, and then a cat pops by, picks up one of the Turtles, and walks off. Now, the cat we saw at the beginning of the first issue, having mutated, and, that left us, what that we finally revealed is that, of course, the turtle he picked up is Raphael. And, we know this is taking place 9 months after they met that mutagen. So, Splinter and the turtles and Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Donatello are all living together searching for Raphael, who we found, wandering the streets and comes in when he sees a father beating a son at the end of the last issue. Now, it starts off with the father actually getting the better of Raphael and beating him up, and I'm kind of going, wait a second, he's a ninja. How is the father actually winning this fight? And it's not till a few scenes later when they show, the cat walking off with Raphael, and we learn that the other three turtles and Splinter have been searching for Raphael, that he's been missing for 9 months. So he doesn't have his ninja skills. So, that being said, there were a couple of things that made me go, what? Yeah, and maybe this is just being nitpicky for a book about turtles that get goo spilled on them and become human. But how good of ninjas can they be after 9 months of training? How good a ninja will Raphael be having missed that 9 months?
And why is it that after way his too father far into up? This.
I know. Aren't I? And the other thing that kind of hurt me was, why after his father is set packing, does Casey Jones say, wait a second, and then go grab a mask and a baseball bat as if to go, fight crime with Raphael? It just, there was no sense of forethought in that part of the story. That irked me. And again, it's a story about turtles mutating and learning ninjutsu. Why is that what bothers me about this? I don't know. but it was fun to read. And, when they get the reprints of issue 3 out, I'll be reading that. So I'll say go read it. Yeah. Especially if you're a Ninja Turtle fan. One of the other things that I like is they went back to what Eastman did in the originals, that they're all wearing red bandanas. Except for Raph, who doesn't have a bandana because he's not a ninja yet.
Well, and not wearing one at all, obviously. Okay. Another one that we both read this week, and this one is coming out of the Vertigo publisher, and that was Unwritten. And I don't know what number this is, but I do know that this is the beginning of the War of the Words, which I'm going to go ahead and say it now at the risk of being absolutely flamed by our listeners. I think this is finally, after whatever 20-some-odd issues that it's been, the story is finally starting. This, I think, is the beginning of the actual story for Unwritten. This is where the fun begins. And that being said, hey, let the good times roll, because from here on out, I think we're going to have a really, really fun book. It's been cool up to now, don't get me wrong. I've loved Unwritten. It's been great stories. It's been interesting and compelling stories. But now I think is when the fun starts.
Yeah, this is really where the fun will begin. This has been a slow burn. They've been building and developing this world. They've been creating this character, Tommy, who didn't believe in himself. And that's really what it was. He didn't believe in himself. Yeah. Not the fact that he was a character, he didn't. Yeah. But he's built this. He's built up his own self confidence, where the people around him have convinced him to build up his self confidence, turned him into a badass, and he's gone out to take names. And we see him kicking ass and taking names in this book. Yeah. He's finally accepted who he is. He's got his own army of his three friends. There's probably going to be some more of those around. And, he's taken the fight to the Cabal. Now, what I'm interested to see is what happens when the Cabal strikes back. This is a powerful group. They have you know, their own strength. They have their own, they have this secret society that, you know, is probably hundreds of people backing them. What's going to happen when they finally retaliate? How are they going to react to Tom finally learning and casting the spells that he did as Tommy in the books? Yeah. So, yeah, the reaction as this war begins is really going to, I think, is going to make this book get really intense really quick. I mean, they've just really started ramping it up over the past 2 months. And you've seen something that's been a long, slow burn that, while a solid story, it's made me kind of go, I wish I was reading this in trade so I could get it much more together. And this now is just kind of going, bam, and now I want to get in trade because it's like, I can't wait to see what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. It's gone from a slow burn of building, I need to understand it all, to just an explosion. I think if you've been reading this book, you're finally going, oh, this is a great payoff. If you haven't read this book, pick up some of the trades. I think reading them as trades is probably going to be better than monthly with this book, because there's so much that they slowly build as they build up this character and the supporting cast around him.
As a great sportscaster once said, boom goes the dynamite.
Indeed. It exploded. So,
A couple of the books worth bringing up. I'm going to go through these really, really quick. Zenoscope had two out this week. The Grim Fairy Tales mainline book and a Grim Fairy Tales Neverland new storyline called Hook. Hook, I think, is really good. The story has developed well. It's a great reintroduction back to the Neverland storyline, which ended before the Dream Eater saga, and in the Dream Eater saga, something happened to Pan, which I'm not going to talk about, and Neverland now brings us back to where we were before the beginning of the Dream Eater saga, where Neverland is its own unique separate world with the characters that are in it. Hook, I think, was good. Grimm's Fairy Tales, the mainline, I'm dropping it. I've had enough of the storyline. I got through the Dream Eater saga, and enough is enough. I've always kind of harped on the fact that Zenoscope have been traditionally just straight up TNA books, and it's the stories that kept them compelling, that actually made them worthwhile. Well, I'm sorry, but this is the nail in the coffin. The story in Grimm Fairy Tales, I feel, has kind of gone to crap. Not that they're horrible, they're not awful stories, but there's just not enough there to make me continue getting this book. The other one from this week that I wanted to hit real quick was the Wheel of Time series. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Before you get to Wheel of Time, going back to the Grimm Fairy Tales Neverland, the book is Neverland Hook. And you mentioned Peter Pan in there because he, of course, being that the book is about Hook, Pan has to be a main character. But for those not familiar with the story of Neverland, of how Hook differs from the traditional Peter Pan mythology. Well, give us a brief breakdown of that, and then go on for a little time.
What we have in the Neverland, the Grim Fairy Tale Neverland storyline, is that it's a flip of the roles. Pan is the villain, Hook is the hero. Pan is actually this malevolent being. You don't know what he is. The background stories actually kind of paint him as being a young child in England that came from a bad family, and he somehow got pulled to Neverland and became the creature that he is today. But the reason he stays eternally youthful is because he goes and gets these lost boys, brings them to Neverland, drains them of their life energy to feed himself to keep him young, very much sort of like a vampire. Hook, whose name escapes me, because it's similar to but different from the actual character. He and his brother were brought to Neverland as children. He escaped. His brother did not. His brother, he believed, was killed by the crocodile, the same crocodile that he lost his hand to. However, he did manage to escape Neverland, had lots of mental issues after that, eventually gets pulled back into Neverland along with his psychiatrist and Wendy, whose two nephews have also been taken by Pan. Pan is defeated by the end of that first Neverland run, expectably, because that's what happens. The good guys win. Which, actually, I'd step back. That's kind of rare in most of these Zenoscope Grim Fairy Tale novels. Usually the good guy doesn't win, so this one's kind of a change to their M.O. Regardless, that's the background of the Neverland story. Tinkerbell is in here, too, but I'm not going to say anything about her because her character is very, very interesting, as is Tiger Lily in the overall scheme of the world. So I'll leave those alone, and if you guys want to check it out, I recommend checking it out. It's worth the read. Moving on, like I said, I want to hit quick.
One other question. With Neverland, should you have read the first part first, or does this pick up at a point where you can pick it up from this issue and go forward?
It might actually be too early to say. From what I can tell from this first issue alone, I don't think you have to. Like, it's not absolutely mandatory that you have read the first storyline. I do think it will really, really help, but not an absolute necessity. So if you wanted to pick it up just from this starting line, I think you can. My quick description that I gave you of the world is more than enough to get you started with this first issue. Time may tell. They may bring up some things in future issues that are callbacks to the original story that might make it more necessary to have read those as well, but obviously I don't know if that's the case yet or not.
Okay, so Wheel of Time.
Okay, Wheel of Time. Still Wheel of Time. Still fantastic. This issue focuses on my favorite character from the Wheel of Time series, which is Perrin. We've reached the point in Eye of the World where Perrin and Egwene have met up with Elias in the woods, and Elias reveals to Perrin that he is a wolf brother. And of course, Perrin is denying it the entire time. Anybody that's read the Eye of the World in the Wheel of Time series knows what I'm talking about. Anybody that hasn't has no idea what the crap I'm talking about. Pick up the comic or pick up the book. You'll understand what I'm talking about. That was it as far as all the individual issues from this week and the past couple weeks that we wanted to touch on. There is a graphic novel that I had actually picked up and I told Jason to read because I thought it was really good. And that was Persepolis. Persepolis is actually a fairly widely acclaimed graphic novel by Marjane Satrapi. Marjane Satrapi is a native-born Iranian who immigrated and naturalized to the United States. And Persepolis is a collection of short graphic stories explaining and describing her time growing up in Iran as a child during the time of the hostage crisis in Iran. Also, it deals a lot with the political changeover that occurred around that time where the religious leaders became more entrenched in the political system of Iran. This is a very adult book, not adult in content, but as far as, you know, what's depicted, adult in the themes and the ideas. This obviously is a autobiographical book, so a lot of history knowledge is useful. If you don't know a lot about what was occurring in the Middle East around that time, you might be at a disadvantage trying to read this and trying to understand it. What is kind of nice, though, is that the book doesn't necessarily focus only on those issues. It focuses more on her and her family and her relationship with other children that she knew at the time and other families and her relatives and how these political changes, which we've probably heard of from our history books to a certain extent, seeing not necessarily the big picture, but the very personal picture, you know, the very humanizing stories that a lot of times I think American audiences wouldn't understand or wouldn't normally see, either because they don't want to or because they just are never given the opportunity to. A lot of times the Middle Eastern cultures, the Middle Eastern Muslim cultures definitely, are made very, they're very dehumanized. It's, they're spoken of in nebulous terms in political and news speak, where everything is neutral, everything is sanitized in a way. So you don't get that human emotional connection to the cultures of that region. It makes them feel very foreign. And this book does a lot to take that away, to really identify with a youth in Iran at that time and being able to fully understand exactly what she's feeling, why she's feeling it, and how her choices and how her decisions are affected by these events around her, and how it doesn't matter what country you're from or what culture you're from, if these things were to happen to you or your family, how it's very easy to understand how you would do and feel the exact same way. I think that's I'm done with my podium piece. I'm going to step aside for a second. Jason, go ahead and tell me what you thought about it.
This was a very good book. And if you've read Mouse by Art Spiegelman, this is a very similar type of book. Instead of being for the Holocaust, it's for the revolution in Iran, when they went from being a free society where they, lived probably not too dissimilar from the way America was at that time. And they had free reign to listen to the music that they wanted to. They didn't have to wear the traditional garb where they had to hide their faces. And so you've got this child that grew up with that at the beginning. And she, from there, the revolution occurs, and now she's forced, when in public, to have to wear the headscarves and not be seen. She's not allowed to, dress in manly clothes, can't wear the normal dress of clothes. She can't listen to music. It talks about, cards were banned. If they were found having playing cards, that would have been a problem. Yeah. And it's written from a child's point of view. And while Justin said this is definitely an adult book, and the topic certainly is something for adults, you could give this to, a young teenager, and they would certainly be able to see and understand everything going on in here. It's very simply drawn, but that reflects the child's eye that it was witnessed with and that it's being told from, because it's her story that she's telling you of how she felt and what she was when she was that child and growing up. And it deals with her own personal faith and her own history as she's dealing with all of these scenarios. And as she grows up, you start to see, the art doesn't really evolve. It stays very simplistic, very easy to understand, but certainly the things that she's dealing with, because she's able to deal with more and process more and understand, she's seeing friends who have family members locked in jail. She has family members that are locked in the prison, families that are fleeing the country. Why does her family stay? Because that's their home. That's why, they stay there, because that's the country that they grew up in. That's where their home is. They don't want to have to leave. Finally, she does leave. Her parents say the best thing for you is to leave the country. And they send her away. Now, there's so much going on. There's even, at one point, there's even a Jewish family they talk about. And you get to see the fear that these people lived in. Were they going to be searched and raided? They had contraband, and the, people that were in charge are going, some of them could be bribed. Some of them were just able to and looking for ways to use their power to get some kicks. But the way that the story is told, the point of view is so unique and so singular that it really will strike a chord, and enlighten you to the world that these people are growing up in. And if you do have that singular view of the Muslim world, I think this is really important to read, because it'll let you see they're not all of the one breed. They're not all people that want to get in planes and fly them into buildings. There's a group of people that were very similar to us that are still like us, that are forced to live in a way that they don't always agree with. And, you know, some of them are living that way because they're scared. Some of them are living that way because that's how they have to be to survive in that society. And you get to see all of that. And now, just to talk about it being a humanizing point of view, I think part of that is the fact that it's written from a child's point of view. You know, we were all children once. We all had things that we grew up and said, wait, that's not the way I remember it. And when you have this story, you know, this is the way that she remembers it. So it just makes it all that more, you know, dramatic and more touching. And the fact that it's done as a graphic novel, is, I think it has a much different impact than it would as a prose book. Now, one thing that was interesting is I actually did a quick search on this right before, and in 2007 they actually did an animated movie. And the art from the movie looks very similar to the art that Marjane actually uses when she makes this book. So, I'd strongly recommend reading the book. And if you enjoy that, go check out the movie. Or, if you're the type of person that needs to watch the movie first, go see the movie and then read the book. I suspect you'll probably get a lot more out of the book as you read each little segment. And it's a quick read. You won't quite realize just how fast you're getting through it. And it's as far as a graphic novel, it's thicker than most comic books, but it's also half as tall. So probably about the same as a regular graphic novel. But really worth checking out.
Yeah. Another point to note is there is actually a sequel to this book as well, although the title escapes me at the moment. There's a very good chance I'll probably pick that up too, and if and when I do, I'll share it around, and you'll hear about it here when we bring it up and review it.
I do want to apologize because we said we'd get to that review a couple shows ago, and so we finally got it in, so there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And we'll get the next one. We'll get that one in here, too. That is it as far as comics for this week. The only other thing I was going to mention is, for those of you who don't know, we're actually recording this on a Thursday evening, Friday morning, as it is now. And as of about 14 minutes ago, Skyrim, the new, the fifth Elder Scrolls game in the Elder Scrolls series, has just been released. I actually pre-downloaded it. It is sitting in Steam right now. And because it is there, I am going to leave and go play the hell out of this game because I've been waiting for this all week. If any of you are out there are gamers, if you're going to be playing Elder Scrolls, shoot us an email. Let me know what type of character you're building, why you're doing it that way, and if you have any comics that you want to hear us talk about or if you have any comments or reviews for things we said this week, by all means, let us know. You can contact us by downloading our episodes at thecomicbooknerd.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at FelixTCat. That's with a K and two T's. You can find Jason at JPolyF at Twitter as well. You can email us at comicbooktesseract@gmail.com. Or for those of you who like good old landlines, you can call us and leave a voicemail at 50Tesseract. That's 508-377-3722. That is it for this week. I am going to go chase down some mammoths and try not to get stepped on by a giant. On behalf of Jason Polyev, I'd like to say thank you all for listening, and we will see you all next week. Take care.